Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. Red letter days, that's a term we hear a lot of. We've all had them. Those are the days that you never forget. Some are very happy days, such as weddings, birthdays, but many are very painful days. A lot of trauma. All of us, everybody here has experienced those. It's times like that that we feel God at work. February the 7th, 2015 is a red letter date for our family. I've been an avid hiker my entire life. That Saturday morning on the 7th, Grant and I went to Nelson County and parked at Crabtree Falls parking lot. We hiked 4.5 miles to the top of a mountain. It's called the Priest. Halfway up the mountain, I put my ice cleats on because there were some patches of ice on the trail. After eating our lunch at the top of the mountain, we returned on the same trail back to the car. We were approximately 1 mile from the parking lot. The last memory I have of that day, the last memory I have for 3.5 weeks, was my cleats grinding on a rock that was covered with glazed ice. That's all it was 3.5 weeks before I remember anything.
I titled this, Prompting from God's Spirit. In the Sojourners class where I'm at, we're listening to the Bema podcast. The Old Testament is full of stories about God's Spirit moving somebody to do something or to go somewhere. I believe God's Spirit was at work prompting people before and during this event. Many people were with Tony and me that day, and I believe were prompted by God's Spirit to be in that area or to get involved. I'm going to talk about 10 different people and events. Number one, myself. Tony called me about a Crabtree Falls hike. I recall immediately saying yes, without even weighing if I had the time. I guess I was one of many. Two, the UVA nursing student. After Tony fell, I quickly got down to Tony and saw his condition was critical. I recall seeing him fall down the slope and was puzzled about why he didn't attempt to break the fall. In hindsight, we believe he hit his head on that first slip on the ice. He tumbled down about a 60-foot slope through brush and rocks and landed in a little dip in the slope. I don't recall how long until I had someone beside me, but it didn't seem very long. She was a UVA nursing student. Tony and I had hiked all day. It was mid-afternoon when this happened. We saw one other group of hikers. So when the UVA nursing student was there, it was a surprise. I thought it was just Tony and I on the trail. Three, EMT hiker. Then another person was beside me, a trained EMT person. She and her boyfriend from Southern Virginia were hiking Crabtree, and she came down to me. We were blessed with trained people that helped Tony and myself. I needed help to remain calm. Four, the call has been made. It dawned on me that someone needed to call 911. I called to the group of hikers on the trail above us. Somebody call, and the response was, the call has been made. Tony and I did not have cell phone service all day, so how did somebody have cell phone service? Five, the ropes guy. I looked up and there was a guy with ropes on his body who was working his way down to us. He worked for search and rescue and heard the call. He said, I came to practice my rope skills. What if I tie ropes from tree to tree on the icy spots on the trail so when we take Tony out, rescue personnel have something to hold on to? We used those ropes on several icy spots. Six, a call for blankets. The EMT person said, we need blankets for Tony. He's getting cold. I called up to the group of hikers, and before long, several hikers' coats came floating down. Seven, a physically fit EMT person. I heard the ambulance below us, and I could see two guys with packs hiking up the winding trail below us. It was icy and steep. One of the guys was in good physical shape and soon separated himself from the other EMT. After a strong hike over icy trails, he was beside us with equipment and tools. 8, the ropes guy again. We got Tony up on a stretcher and put him up on the trail and placed him on the stretcher on a large one-wheel cart. The first bump and the stretcher started to slide off the cart. The ropes guy stepped in, told us the knots were not correct, corrected the knots, and then we were off. 7, the UVA student again. After the ambulance left the parking lot, I was standing there, no idea where Tony had the keys to the vehicle and no cell phone service. Before the ambulance left, I asked the EMT to look in Tony's pocket, no keys. The UVA nursing student said, "I live right across from the hospital. You can ride with me." The keys were in the backpack that I had, but I believe I was not to find those keys. Number 10, the roommate in the car. I was thinking, how do I make this phone call? The UVA nursing student's roommate was with us and advised me what to say and what not to say. Susan was to call Becky and tell her that Tony had been in an accident, was headed to UVA, and that she should go to the hospital, but someone else drive. I was not to disclose how serious we knew it was.
On Saturday, the day of Tony's fall, my daughter-in-law, who lived in Pittsburgh, texted both my daughter Sarah and I and said, "You guys are on my mind today. Is everything okay?" At the time, we thought everything was okay. It was only later, when Sarah reminded me of that text, that I realized God was already working to prompt others to begin holding us up in prayer. I received the call at about 6:30 p.m. on Saturday that Tony had been injured while hiking. He was being airlifted to UVA and that he was in and out of consciousness. I called some close friends, Bobby and Brenda Fairweather, and briefly told them what I knew and asked if they would drive me to UVA. Just as we passed the first Waynesboro exit on 64, I received a call from the social worker at UVA asking if I knew that my husband had been brought into the trauma unit. I said, yes, I knew, and we were on our way there. She said the surgeon wanted to talk to me and would be calling soon and that I should get there as soon as possible. As we crested the top of Afton Mountain, my phone rang again, and it was the surgeon. He said Tony was bleeding significantly in his skull, and it was putting pressure on his brain, and that if they didn't do surgery immediately, he would die. And then he went on to list all the bad things that could happen if they did surgery, and concluded by saying, "But it's his best chance." That was the first I realized just what kind of injuries Tony had. I had expected broken arms and legs and thought he must have hit his head if he was in and out of consciousness. But really, I had no clue that it was this bad. I didn't see Tony when I arrived at the hospital. He was being prepped for surgery. The surgery took about 2 hours, and the nurse called me when it was over and said the surgeon wanted to talk to me. We went up to the third floor neuro ICU unit, and I saw that one of the elders from our church was there with her husband, who was a family physician. The nurse met me and said I could bring one other person with me. I looked around the circle and said, "I want the doctor to go with me." So he went along in and was able to ask appropriate questions and interpret what the surgeon was saying. I was so grateful for his presence and knew that God had gone before me and arranged to have him there when I needed him. My mom found out about Tony's fall the next day on Sunday morning, and I talked to her by phone Sunday evening. She said to me, "Becky, last night before I knew about any of this, I woke up in the middle of the night and just had a heavy feeling about your family. I didn't know what it was, but I prayed for all of you. Now I know what that was about." Again, the Spirit prompted and she listened. In those early days, my dear friend Joy Yoder sent me a text message every morning with a Bible verse and some encouraging words. Each morning when I was trying to gather up my courage to walk back into that hospital, it was so nice to know that someone was thinking of me and praying for me. That simple act might seem like a small, insignificant thing, but to me, it was huge and just the encouragement I needed. On Tuesday of that first week, I came down from ICU and took a little break and encountered Elaine Clymer, Jim Clymer's first wife, in the lobby. She knew I had been struggling. I knew she had been struggling with some significant health issues. She had just received the devastating diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, which had spread to her liver. And we embraced there in the lobby, shed some tears, and tried to comfort each other. During the weeks that followed, I never got to see her again, but she posted words of encouragement several times on Tony's Caring Bridge website, even though she was undergoing her own health crisis. She passed away a couple weeks after Tony returned from the hospital, and I never got to thank her for her words of encouragement. Tony's brother, Tim, who lives in South Georgia, called me the first week of Tony's hospitalization. He wanted to come up and see Tony, but wanted to come at a time that worked for me. I told him that the coming weekend there would be lots of people, but the following weekend would work well for me. I knew he didn't want to wait a whole week before coming, but he agreed to come the following weekend. He arrived on Thursday afternoon of Tony's second week at UVA. And the next morning, Friday morning, we were informed that Tony would be moved to Washington, D.C. for rehab that very afternoon. Tim was right there at my side and able to drive me to D.C. and stay for the weekend to help get Tony settled in. There is no way I could have planned that because I didn't know in advance that it would happen. But I was provided for, and there was no need to make any phone calls and try to arrange for someone to accompany me. God knew and had everything already arranged. The third week after the accident, which would have been the first week Tony was in Washington, D.C., I had an email conversation with my sister-in-law and wrote these words. Someone asked me if I had anyone staying with me at night when I'm home, and really the thought hadn't even occurred to me. I feel so at peace when I'm home. The first night I was alone this week, when I went to bed, I had a vision of an angel with a flaming sword standing guard outside each of my doors. It was so real that the next morning, I actually went to the door to see if there were tracks in the snow. I hold that image in my mind each evening when I go to bed, and I feel peaceful and safe. I don't ever remember feeling any fear on those nights when I was staying at home alone. I really do believe there were angels guarding me. I remember driving home alone from DC for the first time. It was a Monday evening. I had spent the day with Tony in the hospital, meeting the therapists and discussing the care plan. I left the hospital about 7:30 p.m. for the drive home. It had snowed that weekend. I'm a bit intimidated by big city driving, so I was concerned about finding my way out of the city. My son David and I reviewed the route I'd need to take on Google Maps before I left. I remember the feeling of relief when I got to Route 66 and passed the Vienna Metro stop because I knew the way home from there. Several times on that solitary drive home, I almost broke down and wept from the sheer enormity of the situation, from fatigue, from the uncertainty of the future. I kept telling myself I was driving and just had to hang in there until I got home. And I did. I remember pulling into my driveway and just sobbing. I walked into the house. My friends were there with a fire in the wood stove, warm soup in a pot, and a shoulder to cry on, and loving hugs. I was exhausted, but felt very cared for. I didn't want Tony to be alone in DC in a strange place, so it was arranged that someone would stay with him every day that he was there. Family members covered most of the first week, and church friends, some of you here, volunteered to come up the second week. There was always someone there with him during the day when I couldn't be there. We had more volunteers than we had days to fill. This was all organized by someone from our church, Jim Rush, who had volunteered to be the coordinator. I told him what my needs were for volunteers, and he made the calls to line things up. This was a huge blessing because it meant that in addition to all the other things I needed to do, I didn't need to make any of those phone calls. The arrangements were made for me. After they assessed Tony's situation, the rehab hospital told me that they expected Tony's stay to be 3 weeks. So I planned to take off work the entire third week so I could be at the hospital learning about his therapy so I could continue it at home. But in the middle of the second week, they called me to say that Tony was doing so well, they were going to release him that weekend on Saturday. So I scrambled to change my plans. Ron, a friend of Tony's, had been planning to come up on Saturday for the day. So he and my daughter, Sarah, drove up in a van and brought Tony and I home. We arrived home to a plowed driveway. It had snowed again. Warm food and balloons and lots of hugs. We were weary, but so glad to be home and not have the need to drive back and forth to the city again. This began the long journey back from injury through lots and lots of rehab and therapy sessions to the recovery we see today. About a month after Tony came home from the hospital, I had a day where everything seemed to be crashing in on me and I felt like I was losing it. I called my friend Brenda and told her I was falling apart. She and her husband Bobby came over. Bobby stayed with Tony and Brenda took me out to a frozen yogurt shop where we talked and laughed and ate frozen yogurt and just did something normal for a little while. She helped me get my feet back under me so I could go home and keep doing it. During Tony's early recovery, I saw him working harder than anyone I've ever seen. He was determined to come back as far as possible. He faithfully did his exercises several times a day. Gradually, I encouraged him to begin doing other things to assist his recovery, things like building birdhouses in his shop, getting back on his bike and riding miles and miles around the church parking lot. We live right next door to the church here, so. And taking short hikes together after his therapy sessions. I felt like it was important for him to begin doing normal things in a familiar setting to bring back as much memory and skill as possible. We were blessed, by the way, our adult children stepped up and helped us during this time of crisis. Our daughter Sarah was facing a serious health crisis of her own during this time, so she was carrying a double burden. Sarah made quite a number of initial phone calls and contacts that first night while I was headed to the hospital, and I know those were difficult calls to make. Sarah and both of our sons, one who lived in Pittsburgh at the time and one who lived in Washington, D.C., came immediately the next day, stayed several days, and returned several times to support me and be with their dad. And once Tony was moved to D.C., David, our son, stopped by every morning after work, every evening after work for several hours, and spent the entire day with Tony on his days off. In an early conversation with my mom, when I was talking about returning to normal, she told me that things would probably always be different now, but that didn't mean they would be bad. At the time, I didn't want to hear those words. I wanted things to return to the way they had been before, but she was right. I know now that things will always be different, And that's not bad. We are forever changed by this experience. I feel like we had the privilege of having a front row seat to see God at work in countless ways. So even today, 11 years later, we continue the journey back. Some days seem almost normal, but there are other times when we are clearly reminded that things are different. We value our time together and hope we still have many more years to share life together. But I know now that there is a strength available in times of crisis that goes beyond human understanding. Even on that first day, I felt like something came up underneath me and held me up. I've learned that God can absolutely be trusted and that it is really true that He will never leave us or forsake us. I've learned that being part of God's community of believers means that others will come alongside us and help hold us up and bear the burden with us so we don't need to journey alone. We received a huge outpouring of support, prayers, financial gifts, food, cards, firewood, words of encouragement, help with transportation to appointments, caregivers to come be with Tony when I could, so I could begin returning to work, and lots of love and care. This is not an experience I would ever wish on anyone, and yet we are better people for having walked through it. And I've learned that God is a God of resurrection. He turns death into life. He is a mighty redeemer who can take a devastating event and turn it into something holy. Praise be to God.
In addition to some of the support that Becky mentioned, some of you here, Audrey Shang, she made a prayer shawl for me. Jackson Moss, he was the very first physical therapist I've met with. Jerry Rush did our taxes and gave financial assistance. Our neighbor Chad Ash mowed the yard the whole first summer. Susan Stolzfus, Grant's wife, made a picture book of a group hike just the year before. It was full of good memories. Bobby Fairweather, he took off work every Tuesday for 7 months to come to the house and stay with me. A hiking partner of mine made all the arrangements, it was his idea, to take me to Arizona to hike the Grand Canyon 3 years after I fell. I couldn't have done that by myself. Without this support, I don't think recovery would be the extent there is now. I don't think it would have been possible. It needed the help. We're often asked about recovery, my recovery. I'd like to read a quote from one of the books Becky gave me. The book is Learning to Live with Yourself After Brain Injury. This is a paragraph in the book. There are some hard realities we must face. There is no such thing as recovery. No one recovers from a brain injury the way someone else recovers from it. Someone recovers from an illness. You don't get released from the hospital, hug your family and friends, and return to work. You don't pick up where you left off in your life as though nothing happened. Life is not the same as it was before. Something will always be different. The poster you see up here is kind of to help illustrate that. That was sent to me by the local brain recovery group, which meets with people going through this to help them recover. They sent me this up here. It is so true to this day. When I did go back to work after a couple years, tried to work, I put that right on my door so that anybody came in the door to my office could read it. So they know what they're getting ready to see, because it is so true. I had about 250 therapy sessions. And most of those sessions were actually speech therapy. After 11 years of recovery, I still struggle with many of those issues. 9 months after my accident, a group of friends and family, most all from this congregation, went back to Crabtree Falls to see where this accident happened. It was a very, very powerful experience. Becky and I put together a little video with pictures and some music. I heard this song when I was about a year after the accident, when I started driving. I didn't drive for a year. I heard this song played by Ricky Skaggs, and I thought, that's my song. It meant so much to me. So I came home, played for Becky, and we got people's cameras, had some pictures on. We put it together with this song. We'll show you that in a little bit. It's just pictures of my life, our life. You'll see some pictures on there, like a room's got all my hiking supplies in it. You'll see pictures of the hospitals where I was at. You'll see pictures of some of the recovery activities, like Becky talked about, riding bike. You'll see a series of pictures of the nine of us walking up to where the accident happened. And the very last picture you'll see was one my 7-year-old grandson, Zach, made at the time. The video is set to music. Listen carefully to the words, because they are particularly meaningful to me, and I think to the whole congregation.
Somebody's praying, I can feel it. Somebody's praying for me. Mighty hands are guiding me to protect me from what I can't see. Lord, I believe. Lord, I believe somebody's praying for me. Angels are watching, I can feel it. Angels are watching over me. There's many miles ahead till I get home. Still I'm safely kept before your throne. 'Cause Lord, I believe. Lord, I believe your angels are watching over me. Now I've walked the barren wilderness where my pillow was a stone, and I've been through the darkest caverns where no light has ever shone. Still I went on, 'cause there was someone who was down on their knees. And Lord, I thank you for those people praying all this time for me. Somebody's praying, I can feel it. Somebody's praying for me. mighty hands are guiding me to protect me from what I can't see. Lord, I believe. Lord, I believe. Somebody's praying for me. Somebody's praying for me.